My name is Einat Wilf, and this is the We Should All Be Zionists podcast. Each week, I'll be reading one essay from my latest collection of essays book, We Should All Be Zionists, on issues facing the Jewish people and Israelis today: conflict, peace, religion, politics, past, present, and future. At the end, I'll be joined by columnist Blake Flayton for a discussion on the themes of the essay and how they apply to contemporary Israel and Jewish life. You can purchase your own copy of We Should All Be Zionists anywhere you get your books. Thanks for listening. Let's start. How Not to Think About the Conflict. Essay for Sapir Journal, April 2021. Over a year ago, pre-COVID, when delegations of students were still coming to Israel on planes, I met with a group to discuss Israel, Zionism, and the conflict. During the Q&A session, I was asked by one student to comment on how colorism affects the conflict between Jews and Arabs, Israelis and Palestinians. While I had often heard this question framed in the context of racism, it was the first time I was asked about the conflict as one of colorism. Reflecting on this question, I thought that perhaps it had finally dawned on those studying the conflict that to the extent that race means anything, Jews and Arabs definitely do not constitute two separate races. So perhaps someone thought variations of skin tone, color, would make sense of the conflict in a way that Americans could understand. Since analyzing the conflict in terms of skin tones made about as much sense as race, and since the talk took place in a hotel meeting room in Jaffa, I simply challenged the young student to go out into the city where the population is a mix of Arabs and Jews, and upon her return, tell me whether she could tell Jews apart from Arabs based only on their color. Even without going outside, she admitted she was not likely to be able to do so. Marshalling all my patience gained from years of having to address false parallels and analogies, I explained that Jews and Arabs, Israelis and Palestinians, are engaged in a century-old conflict that rests on issues of nation, religion, theology, tribes, receding empires, carved-out states, history, and geography, all great and relevant lenses from which to analyze it. Race and color are not. Normally, we expect people to try to understand things that are foreign to them by placing them in a familiar framework and by drawing parallels with their own situations. Having discussed the conflict over the years with groups from India, China, Japan, Europe, Africa, and Latin America, I was always struck by the parallels they found between, on one hand, the history of the Jews, Zionism, and the conflict, and on the other, their own countries and people's histories. Those were always interesting for me to hear, and I considered them an honest effort by people to grapple with a place and a people that were not their own. But unlike these earnest attempts to understand a foreign place and people, some parallels are more ill-intentioned, drawn for the express purpose of intervening in the conflict on behalf of one side or for reasons that are more about the domestic issues of the people drawing the comparisons than about the conflict itself. Drawing parallels to cast one side in the conflict as evil and the other as good might have the effect of marshalling support and resources for the side that one favors, but such a strategy is counterproductive and even just plain stupid if the goal is actually to engage with the real issues at hand, to solve the conflict and attain peace. Evil must always be fought and defeated. So to cast the conflict as a fight between good and evil is effectively to argue that no compromise can be made until the other side disappears or signs an unconditional surrender. For decades, critics have cast Jews, Israel, and Zionism as the evil side in the conflict through their consistent and persistent employment of the placard strategy, utilizing simple equations such as those that might appear on a placard in an anti-Israel demonstration. On one side of the equation are Israel, Zionism, and images such as the Star of David. The evil du jour is the other side, whether it is imperialism, colonialism, racism, apartheid, or for the truly determined genocide and Nazism. Most recently, white supremacy was added to the list. The placard strategy is so effective that it is employed everywhere and anywhere, from the United Nations, Zionism equals racism, to the International Criminal Court, Israel equals crimes against humanity, to various media and social media, where anti-Israel speakers invariably manage to respond to any question regarding Israel with the words apartheid, racist, and colonialist, regardless of the question or topic discussed. These words are considered a standard reply to Israelis posting photos of themselves eating ice cream in Tel Aviv. The placard strategy has never been about actual facts and policies. If there was ever a time when it was at least used for purposes that had to do with the conflict itself, that time has passed. Nowadays, the equations and parallels reflect more on the domestic concerns of the protesters than they illuminate any real issues in Israel and the Middle East. I first saw this phenomena when visiting Ireland and Northern Ireland several years ago. As I traveled around and met with officials, the analogy emerged. Israel equals Protestants, Northern Irish or Britain, and the Palestinians equal Irish Catholics. As I visited sites throughout Belfast, the Protestant areas were flying Israeli flags and the Catholic areas had Palestinian flags, creating an eerie feeling that the Northern Irish conflict, supposedly ended by the Good Friday Agreement of 1998, was still simmering. It wasn't just the flags. Catholics and Protestants alike described the Israeli-Palestinian conflict with intense emotion, usually coupled with remarkable ignorance. One Sinn Féin member of parliament even went so far as to accuse Israel of committing genocide, which is when I realized that these emotions had nothing to do with our conflict and everything to do with their own. It was as if, with our struggle officially resolved, the Catholics and Protestants couldn't let go. They needed a new way to channel, experience, and display the full range of intense emotions that had fueled them during their own struggle. But this time, of course, they bore none of the consequences of these feelings and opinions. My colleague, Igal Ram, once termed this a Disneyland of hate. For those outside the actual Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it was a safe Disneyland way of experiencing a roller coaster of intense emotions missing from their dull post-peace lives. In a world that is actually more peaceful than ever, and where negative, violence-related emotions such as hatred, and especially hatred of groups and collectives, are less legitimate than ever, the continuing acceptance of hatred for Israel endures. Couching it in terms of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict enabled some Irish Catholics a rare and safe outlet for the open expression of the least legitimate emotion of all, hate, in a world where their own official peace agreement had failed to eliminate intense negative emotions built over decades of conflict. A visit to South Africa provided me with a similar experience. Especially after the 2010 World Cup, South Africa had successfully rebranded itself as the post-apartheid rainbow nation. But the situation on the ground was one where apartheid and its effects continued to exist in practice, if not in name. Challenges of rampant poverty, inequality, illiteracy, and corruption plagued the country. Yet many of the young people I met seemed possessed by what they viewed as the urgent need to fight apartheid Israel. Noticing once again the intensity of their emotions, I realized that they too had bought a ticket to this Disneyland of hate. Their parents and grandparents had actually fought apartheid in South Africa, paying a hard price, but also experiencing the glory not only of common struggle, but of victory. Life for their children was not so dramatic, Their job instead was the dull and exhausting work of solving the deep-seated problems that apartheid had created, continuing the glorious battle, just transposing it onto a faraway land with no regard for the actual situation there, meant they could tap into the glory without experiencing any of the pain. In the United States, the discussion of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict increasingly resembles this Disneyland of hate. If American discussions of the conflict were once focused on the conflict itself and on specific policy proposals designed to advance its resolution, this is clearly no longer the case. Like in Ireland and South Africa, the conflict has become a stand-in for American positions, where self-styled social justice warriors substitute the hard and tedious work of addressing domestic challenges with the vicarious heroism of fighting for the grand ideal of Palestinian rights. America is increasingly removed from its years of glorious global victories and celebrated domestic battles. The last war it won was cold, and its recent hot wars have been a string of sorry messes. Even the military-industrial complex has realized that it can sell more weapons by promoting peace. The grand battles for civil rights and liberation have attained so much that the current battles for equity and equality now require a consistent focus on far more tedious issues like infrastructure, health, and education. In the absence of these exciting opportunities to defeat real Nazis in actual wars or to attain decisive gains for civil rights, those who claim to promote social justice have latched onto the conflict in Israel in a desperate effort to appear, if only to their own in-group, as heroic warriors for justice. It is as if the conflict serves as a hallucinatory drug for those seeking to escape a dull reality and tedious long-term challenges, allowing them to imagine themselves engaged in a heroic struggle between good and evil, where victories are swift and definitive, to be Captain America and save the day. And so, in an act of blatant neocolonialism, the American story is viewed as the universal prism through which all societies should be understood and analyzed. Blindly ignorant of the specificity of their own experience, the neocolonialists fit the square peg of the conflict into the round hole of American history. Jews are bizarrely cast as white, and Zionism as a movement of white supremacy, while Arabs, who look exactly like Jews, Fauda, anyone, are cast as people of color. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is cast as a mirror of race relations in America, but without the relevant local context of slavery, Jim Crow, or any of the specificities of Jewish, Arab, or Middle Eastern history. Since these analogies have nothing to do with Israel and everything to do with projections of domestic issues and animosities, the best response is simply to refuse to give them the respect of treating them as honest arguments and dismiss the pretension that these issues have anything to do with Israel or Zionism. At most, the response should acknowledge and address the underlying domestic issues rather than their anti-Zionist mask. The irony is that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict doesn't provide much in the way of heroism anymore either. It is one of the least violent conflicts in the world, leading to far fewer violent deaths than most American cities experience each year. The contours of the slow separation between the State of Israel and an emerging Palestinian state are becoming more defined, and Israelis and Palestinians continue their close security cooperation. The growing normalization between Israel and many Arab states points to a regional exhaustion with the conflict, and a sense that Israel is part and parcel of the Middle East. A dull gray envelops a region that once seemed to promise grand battles between good and evil, black and white, Armageddon and salvation. Yet in a world where so much is colored in dull gray, the market for black and white is as strong as ever. If actual real-life Israelis, Arabs, and Palestinians are not going to supply the grand battle for right and wrong, then those who are addicted to this hallucinatory drug will have to invent it. Yes, There are serious, complicated, and appropriate ways to understand the conflict between Israel, its Arab neighbors, and the Palestinians. None of them includes a grand battle between good and evil. But I can testify that when I sit with audiences and talk about the history of Ottoman decline, or the rise of nation states to replace receding empires, or the interplay of various imperial and Cold War interests with those of various ethnic and religious groups, the eyes of most people glaze over. They want to know, who are the good guys? Who are the bad? Which side should I root for? Who is my team? But Israelis and Palestinians, Jews and Arabs, are not sports teams. They are not stand-ins for good and evil, symbols for the struggles in one's own group much closer to home. They are not a drug for generating intense feelings in a dull reality. Israelis and Palestinians, Jews and Arabs, are real people. They are struggling to resolve centuries-long conflicts, which they are slowly doing. That is a far better use of their time than serving as props and collateral damage in the domestic morality tales of other countries, giving an outlet for people to channel negative emotions with which they should be dealing on their own. Which is why increasingly Israelis and even Palestinians watch the intense debates taking place halfway across the world in their name and are left wondering, what does all of this have to do with us?
So, Einat, you just finished reading a very important essay, How Not to Think About the Conflict. And one of the most important points I believe that you bring up is that people who are outside of the conflict, people who are separated from it, choose the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and assign morality and think of Israelis and Palestinians as if they were sports teams, one side being good, one side being evil. And my first question is, why Israelis and Palestinians? There have been plenty of conflicts throughout the world in the last 100 years, and there are obviously more than one conflict facing the world today, Russia and Ukraine, to give an example. Why is this piece of land, these two groups of people, pinpointed as the emblems of our own domestic grievances, the grand morality between, you know, Armageddon and salvation, et cetera, et cetera? Why do you think we are burdened with filling in people's fantasies or serving as characters for people's fantasies?
The short answer, of course, is because Jews. And the longer answer is that certainly in the West, so all the civilizations that have been built on the substrate of Christianity already have a built-in 2-millennia-long cultural investment in the role of the Jew as part of a grand morality tale in which there is good and there is evil, there is one and there is the other. So it just fits very neatly into something that already exists. But you're also seeing that, let's say, Ukraine and Russia, which also separated people and people chose sides, it also has to do with the fact that Russia also has like a historical role in the Western imagination. So wherever you see pre-existing cultural capital, so Jews already being invested with that role in the Western imagination, it just builds on that. Whereas, I don't know, you're too young, but during the war in Yugoslavia.
Heard of it, yeah.
People didn't know who to root for because it was just a whole damn mess of people who kind of seemed the same. You're definitely seeing it in conflicts that are raging right now in Africa with massive violence and displacements. People are like, we don't know who's against whom. But when it comes to the Jews, it's very clear to people they already have, again, millennia of investment of cultural capital in knowing that the Jew is the thing that gets invested with the morality tale, the otherness, the being the emblem of evil, and it just fits very neatly.
Right. And because of that capital, because of that really centuries-long understanding of the place of the Jew or stories about the place of the Jew in the Christian imagination. You know, there's a quote that if the Jew didn't exist, the anti-Semite would have to invent him to sort of project their own grievances about their own lives. And that sort of fits with the conflict as well. Do you think that even if this conflict were to be solved tomorrow in a way that was nonviolent, where both peoples had their right to self-determination, obviously speaking in utopia-like terms, but people lay down their arms and there is no war. Do you think that, I mean, it almost seems like the West, Westerners, would have to invent an Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and that perhaps anti-Israel vitriol and anti-Zionism would only get louder and would only demand more of its American representatives and people involved in the conflict or people involved in the negotiations overseas. All of this activism would simply get more intense because they don't want to give up that outlet. They don't want to give up that grand morality play where they can use to wink at their own domestic concerns. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I would even go further that the anti-Semite is constantly engaged in the invention and reinvention of the Jew. I mean, we all experience it. A bit of what I describe in this essay is this feeling of going to places where I'm a Jew, I represent or I'm part of like the current collective Jew, the state of Israel, and I'm meeting people who address me as an invented thing. And I notice and I experience the gap between my sense of reality as an actual Jewish person, as a member of the collective Jewish nation, and their invention of what I am, and the understanding that like the Jew lives in their mind in a way that is unrelated to me. So what you bring is the thing that I question constantly and that I almost fear to acknowledge, that the need for the Jew in the collective mindset of both mostly Christian and Muslim civilizations is so big that it's not only that if there were peace, they would find a way to say something else. They're actually involved in preventing peace. They're actually fueling the conflict. They're fueling the Palestinian mindset that they are fighting evil rather than a conflict that needs to be resolved through serious diplomatic policies because they need it. And in many ways, I sometimes consider it a tragedy of both Israelis and Palestinians that Israelis are made to play that role, but you could say we have an experience in it. And now Palestinians have been drafted to play that role opposite the collective evil Jew. And at the end of the day, it's a terrible fate and a tragedy for a people to have to serve that role.
Right, right. Why do you think the people who are most vocal about America's outsized influence in the world, like people on the hard left of the spectrum who rail against American imperialism and colonialism and, you know, NATO's reach and our culture's influence on so many countries and peoples in a negative sense. Why do you think these people are the most susceptible to viewing conflicts around the world through dynamics born and bred in America, such as racial relations? Why does that blaring hypocrisy exist where someone could consider themselves non-American centric at all and, you know, extremely cosmopolitan, anti-nationalist, but when it comes to thinking about other regions, other lands, other peoples, they have an extremely difficult time not taking into account American history and American domestic issues.
But that is the most American-centric view.
Right.
Because once, you know, once you have this like outside view and that everything is America and that everything that is evil in the world is the making of America. And like, and everything that happened in America is the prism through which you look at it. That's why I called it neocolonialism. And it's even like the worst kind, because it's neocolonialism that doesn't understand that that's what it is.
Right.
Just
it thinks it's anti-colonialism.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. And it's just somehow sees everything and everyone through the prism of American. Now, like I said, everyone works from their own cultural references, and people try to understand things through parallels to their own cultural references. But what I've seen with this whole racial prism is really the imposition. That's why it has this very colonial element, because it imposes on other places something that is entirely not organic.
Right. And finally, you mention in this piece that, you know, it's very silly to invest all of this energy in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and to think of it as this grand morality play between good and evil, because especially at the time when you were writing this, this conflict produced less casualties than many other places in the world, including many places inside the United States. You know, the murder rate in places like LA and Chicago is just astronomical. And to most people living in Israel-Palestine, reality simply isn't that dramatic, or they aren't afraid to leave their houses like you are in urban cities in the West. And I can attest to them, and particularly during COVID, it was scary how bad crime was. But no one obviously was putting, you know, any sort of morality, Armageddon, redemption onto those dynamics. However, then October 7th happened, and now we are in a war where thousands of people from both sides have died. Does that argument still hold water? Is that argument still legitimate, that you shouldn't be focusing so much, and the fact that you are focusing so much reveals something sinister?
So actually, having written this 3 years ago demonstrates that when people claim that the only reason they're responding in this way is because of the violence, is a reversal of causality.
Right.
Because if you were to just wake up now, then you would say, look, there is violence and people are responding to violence. End of story. And that seems reasonable, unless you know the history. So now I have this essay written 3 years ago, which said, even when there was nothing, there was no violence, it made no sense, still people were projecting these morality tales. Still there were actually claims of genocide that preceded what's happening now. So this actually helps me prove that the causality is reversed. First, people have their morality tales, then they impose it on the conflict. Sometimes it seems to fit a little more, most of the times not, but it's always actually not related to what's happening on the ground, and much more into what's happening in people's heads and their own need for these morality tales.
Right. I mean, and that goes to when you bring up genocide in this piece, and how people often accuse genocide, or at, you know, international bodies, people accuse Israel of committing crimes against humanity. This was obviously before the genocide charge brought by South Africa. And it just goes to show, oh, so this was already happening before there was a war in Gaza with mass casualties. So it's like a boy who cried wolf. Well, why are they actually accusing Israel of genocide? Is it because the facts on the ground changed? It wouldn't appear so, because they've been using this same word forever, when it was inconceivable to even accuse Israel of genocide, because like you said, there actually wasn't a lot of, there actually weren't a lot of casualties here from violence. My last question that I wanted to ask you, and it relates to Northern Ireland and Ireland, but it also relates to the U.S., and maybe it's a question you might not have the answer to yet, but does the Israel-Palestine conflict have the power to reopen wounds? Because it is a smokescreen for, let's say, previous conflicts that maybe have been paved over, like, you know, with the civil rights movement in the United States, or with racial progress in the United States, or with the Good Friday Agreement in Ireland. But is the Israel-Palestinian conflict so powerful, and is it so symbolic in these imaginations, that it actually has the capability to be used as a vehicle to reopen conflicts across the world in those different spaces? I think, like, if you look at America, where you see, you know, pro-Palestinian protesters ripping down American flags outside Grand Central Station right after October 7th and creating this mayhem and this war online between conservatives and liberals, it was very reminiscent of the 2020 Black Lives Matter riots, where people were talking about, you know, disrespecting public squares. And then in Britain, Rishi Sunak made a statement a couple weeks ago about defacing war memorials, British war memorials. It alludes back to that summer of rage, which we all, you know, knew to be, these were domestic issues boiling over. Does Israel-Palestine have that power to derail those conversations again?
What I fear is that what it does, it actually deflects from these conversations. It actually prevents societies from dealing with real issues. And that, in many ways, was the message of the essay, that societies that face real challenges, and every society faces some kind of challenges, but especially societies that face challenges that require hard work, difficult, long-term, sometimes just, you know, kind of gray, exhaustive work, they're more inclined to redirect the energy to something that's more heroic, good versus bad, good versus evil, rather than saying, okay, we need to begin to look at how we have better infrastructure and better healthcare and more equitable distribution of resources. A lot of people try to run away from that kind of long-term work, and it's just much more fun. That's the idea of Disneyland, to do these kind of grand pronouncements. And my fear is that societies are actually wasting their energy going in that direction. It's ultimately a scapegoating mechanism. It's a deflecting mechanism that they would better use all that energy for their own societies to fix their own problems.
So maybe one might say that the obsession with Israel-Palestine follows the historical trend of anti-Semitism, in which case putting attention on the Jews is simply to deflect from pressing domestic crises.
Precisely. I mean, that's my definition of anti-Semitism, not a conspiracy theory, not a prejudice, but a political scapegoating mechanism of failed societies or societies in crisis that tends to be especially effective in those societies where already you have invested cultural capital in the Jewish scapegoat.
I would agree. And I would really hope that the pro-Israel world would get on board with that definition as well, so that we could all stop saying Jew hatred, thinking repeating it over and over again is going to get people to change. Thank you so much, Einat. Fascinating conversation.
Thank you.
מתעורר, מה שהוא מתעורר.